Tonight, mostly clear skies. Lows will be near 50. Tomorrow, a chance of rain in the afternoon. Otherwise, partly cloudy. Highs will be near 70. And for tomorrow night, showers are likely and possibly a thunderstorm. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a low around 59. It's currently 48 degrees. Relative humidity is 90%. Winds are out of the northeast at 5 miles per hour. You're listening to WGTD News.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the next several days, we're going to be devoting a great deal of time on the morning show to the important topic of Alzheimer's disease. We're prompted to do this in part because of an important presentation that's going to be taking place at the University of Wisconsin Parkside this Wednesday morning, October 12th, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., a presentation called The Problem of Alzheimer's, given by Dr. Jason Karlowish from the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, one of the country's most renowned experts on Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Karlowish was my guest on this past Thursday's morning show. And if by chance you missed our conversation, I would encourage you to seek it out in the morning show archives on our website, WGTD.org, or to find it via the podcast version of the program. At any rate, there is more to be said about Alzheimer's, and we're going to be exploring some of that over the next several days. And in part one of today's morning show, you're going to be hearing an interview which I recorded back in 2003 with David Schenck, the author of a book which many still regard as perhaps the definitive book about Alzheimer's disease. His book is titled The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic. It served as the inspiration for a PBS documentary of the same name. Again, this interview with David Schenck about The Forgetting was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2003. David Schenck, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Could you tell me, please, first of all, how you have come to be so deeply interested in this particular topic?
It wasn't something on the top of my to-do list, I can tell you that. I do not have Alzheimer's disease in my family. So many people are forced into this world. I was forced in another way. I was dragged in another way. I overheard a conversation about 5 or 6 years ago now in a restaurant here in Brooklyn where I live. And it was a middle-aged couple, and the wife had what I now understand to be early onset Alzheimer's disease. She was in her 50s, and she was in the middle stages of the disease. She'd gotten to the point where she was very, very confused, and she didn't know who her husband was anymore. And I understood that she was still living at home. So her husband was her primary caregiver, still sharing the home that they had shared for, you know, presumably for decades. And here they are. They should be in the prime of their lives, and now this woman is fading away from her husband ever so slowly. And I just could not imagine anything more tragic or more sad. And I now realize that I, like everyone out there, was just terribly afraid of Alzheimer's disease and was just doing my best not to think about it. And I was not in that luxury anymore. The kind of fear was pushed to the front of my brain. And I just had a million questions that I had to answer about where this disease came from and how long it's been around and what's going on inside that brain and what are we doing to stop it.
Hmm. You say that we avoid it because we just don't like to explore such awful thoughts, the possibility that we might succumb or if someone we love has been diagnosed. But you say we cannot, of course, truly avoid it. Alzheimer's penetrates every aging adult's consciousness just as it penetrated Aristotle's and Swift's and Tolstoy's. And you obviously believe that that penetration needs to happen even more deeply so that we not only... So we do more than just have fleeting, awful thoughts of this possibility, but that we really confront the possibility and do something about it.
Yeah, it's time that everyone in the world, basically, everyone plugged into society, whether they have been forced into this awful world or not, pay some really serious attention to this disease because it is not going to spare anyone, basically. If you have been lucky enough not to have Alzheimer's in your family or among your close friends, unfortunately, that's not going to last because the situation is that Alzheimer's becomes a serious risk for people who live to a nice old age, and the disease, it turns out, has always been with us as human beings. I mean, for thousands and thousands of years, at least. But only in the last century did we actually start living long enough to make it a significant risk for so many of us. And now it's this essential paradox of aging. We all want to live to be into our 80s, 90s, and even beyond. So many of us have the capacity to do so with nutrition and hygiene and exercise and so forth. But the reward for that, unfortunately, is a vastly increased chance of getting this disease.
You quote truly alarming statistics, including the one that appears on the back of your book, I think, about the age 85. Once we get to that age, nearly half of us would have the potential of experiencing Alzheimer's.
The group of Americans 85 and older, one study shows that almost half of them have Alzheimer's disease. It starts out, the risks start to become very serious at age 65. Roughly 1% of 65-year-olds have Alzheimer's. Roughly 10% of 75-year-olds have Alzheimer's. Roughly 20% of 85-year-olds. But then if you take the group of 85 and older, that's approaching 50%. So you can see that year by year after age 65, it just becomes a very, very serious risk.
Hmm. Before we probe into a few more details about the disease itself, I want to touch on something which you mentioned, I think, in the afterword of the book. You sort of follow up on some of your initial observations about Alzheimer's with some updates. And then at the end you say, I continue to be humbled by the energy of the professionals committed to this disease and the eloquence of the caregivers and patients caught up in it. Thank you all for allowing an outsider into your sorrowful, hopeful, bountiful world. I love the way you put that. And I want you to just talk for a couple of minutes, if you would, about the way in which you as an author went about as an outsider probing into such heartbreaking corners of people's personal lives. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I entered this disease as an outsider, as I've explained already, and just with a very basic human fear of getting this disease and of having people in my family get this disease. And I've just very selfishly did not want to get it, and I wanted to know, you know, what we were doing about it. And I came at this first as a science journalist. I wanted to know, you know, I'm trained to know that there are just amazing scientific revolutions going on right now, particularly in brain science. And I wanted to meet the scientist heroes who are going to stop this before I have to face it. I mean, it doesn't get any more selfish than that, right? But I did meet those people, and there are thousands and thousands of those people. And listeners need to know that it is just an entire universe spread throughout the world of just extraordinary people who have dedicated their lives to trying to stop this disease. But the interesting thing that happened to me along the way is that I also, of course, met a lot of caregivers, a lot of patients dealing with this disease. And I realized that the real heroes of this disease are the caregivers who are facing extraordinary hardship, difficulties they couldn't have conceived of earlier on in life, having loved ones who they spent lifetimes with suddenly start to fade away ever so slowly, having to deal with the emotional turmoil of that, and also having to deal with the physical burdens of that, which can be just very costly in every way. And what I saw just time and time and time again is these very ordinary people with very ordinary resources doing extraordinary things. Ordinary people becoming heroes, being extremely brave, and turning into poets. I read letters and heard statements that were just so lyrical and eloquent. And I'm supposed to be the professional writer here, and I was just, you know, the things that were coming out of these people's mouths, it's just they face this incredible hardship, and it turns them into heroes, into poets. And it was very humbling in that way, and I'm just honored to have been invited into their world.
We're speaking with David Schenck, author of The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic. A documentary based on his book airs tonight on PBS. You tell us the story, I had not ever read it before, of the woman in 1901 who is hospitalized in Frankfurt, Germany, with a host of problems, but loss of memory and drastic mood shifts among them. And she is treated by a young doctor named Alzheimer. And, of course, that is the moment in time when this disease, or that's not the moment, but that sets in motion the events by which this disease is finally named. But you go on to say that we have all kinds of evidence, of course, that Alzheimer's is not that new at all, that there are even significant figures in history who most likely succumbed to Alzheimer's.
Yes. What happens when you start looking at history, and I just, in order to do this, I was able to enlist the help of a lot of different historians from different cultures and different periods in history. And I said, you know, obviously the term Alzheimer from Alois Alzheimer goes back to the early 20th century. So we're not going to find Alzheimer's disease in texts older than that. But let's look for things like senile dementia. Let's look for dotage. Let's look for things that words that would have been used. And when you start poking around, you discover that what we now call Alzheimer's disease has been around as long as human beings have. I mean, the ancient Greeks mentioned it. Shakespeare wrote about it quite extensively. There is a reference in ancient Egypt, 2800 BC, to what we now call Alzheimer's disease. And it's interesting because the disease has never been around in huge numbers until the 20th century, simply because not that many people lived long enough to actually get the disease. But it has always been around, and writers and observers have always taken note of it, because I think that Alzheimer's disease is such a powerful disease, not just for the people who are suffering from it, which, of course, is just a devastating experience, but it also sends, it tells us something about ourselves. When you watch someone who isn't just dying in an instant, who isn't just fading away in an instant, but is fading away over a period of 8 to 10 to 15 years, you are learning an awful lot about the human condition. You are watching the memory, the distinction between memory and self. You are watching a personality unwind. And there are a lot of really fascinating things to be learned about humanity by watching that process. And so what I did, in addition to trying to explain this cruel disease in the book, was try to learn what lessons we can take from the disease and even appreciate that aspect of the disease, at least the insights that it gives us after we hopefully cure it.
One thing you mentioned is that not only are there more people living longer, and so more people succumbing to Alzheimer's. You call it the dark unintended consequence of the century's great advances in hygiene, nutrition, and medicine. But you go on to say that something else that is new now is that we have with us many more early-stage dementia sufferers still functioning well enough to fully understand what lay ahead. In other words, there are more people now diagnosed earlier with Alzheimer's, where they still have enough presence of mind to understand what that diagnosis means. And clearly that presents certain challenges for those who want to care for them.
Absolutely. I mean, that fact is changing the entire landscape of Alzheimer's right now as we speak, is that so many people are now aware of this disease, and our diagnostic tools are getting better and better. And it used to be that it was fairly rare, I think, for people to get diagnosed in the early stages. And now we're diagnosing people in the earliest of possible stages, before really the symptoms are even that serious. And, you know, we actually, they've come up with something that's kind of pre-Alzheimer's that they think will then develop into Alzheimer's. That's how early they're starting to detect this disease. And what that means is that families, on the plus side, what that means is that families can start to face their future. It's empowering. They can make decisions that they may not have been able to make earlier on. On the minus side, you're aware of your fate. You are as a patient, you are now aware of what's going to happen to you, and that arguably is just a very cruel piece of knowledge to have.
Absolutely. You pose later in the book the question, how will we face this new abundance of frailty if we are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, or someone we love is? You talk in especially interesting detail, I think, about the onset of Alzheimer's. You call it a disease of insidious onset because it has no definitive starting point. And so that makes it a particularly difficult disease to begin, because it is not abrupt. Its beginning is imperceptible. And up until recently, then, the earliest stages of Alzheimer's were probably missed altogether.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things the film highlights is that we are very quickly getting to the point, thank goodness, where we're going to be able to use medical tests to determine one way or another whether or not the plaques and tangles that cause Alzheimer's are in fact in our brain, so that we can try to eliminate some of this uncertainty. Because what happens for so many people as they get into their 60s and 70s is a very normal aging process. Your memory starts to get less sharp, and so many people are worrying that you know, when they forget a name or can't find their keys right away or their glasses, all of which happens to me quite often at age 37, I should add, that this is the beginning of Alzheimer's disease. And it's important that people realize that there is something called normal aging and normal age-related memory loss. It just happens. It's something we just can't do anything about. And that Alzheimer's is, although it does start, you know, in the very, very early stages, it looks like that, it really, it gets quite a bit more serious than that. And the memory problems that we're talking about in the real early stages of Alzheimer's are slips that the patients will not even remember having. So if you are racking your brain because you couldn't remember a name 10 minutes ago and you're trying to remember it again, that's not Alzheimer's disease, because the memory of not remembering in Alzheimer's disease is not even going to be there.
Hmm. You talk about how the way we build our memories is with a sensory buffer where we take something in, and then there's short-term memory where the brain can hold something for maybe seconds or minutes before it dissolves away, and then some memory is converted into long-term memory that might last years or even a lifetime. You also map for us how different parts of the brain have very different functions in terms of memory and other mental function. And I had no idea that we knew so specifically what parts of the brain are attacked one by one. It's as though it's kind of the geographical progression of an invading army through the brain.
It's when you start to look at it very closely, it's even more overwhelming when you see what these plaques and tangles do and how they systematically start in this one part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is associated with, as you said, with the formation of what we might call short-term memories. And then over many years' time, they kind of march through the brain with this in this very predictable fashion. And I think people know, listeners, even the general audience knows enough about the brain to know that the brain is a specialized collection of organs, and different parts of the brain do different things for us. So what happens with these plaques and tangles is, as they get to a different area of the brain and start to destroy the neurons and the synapses in that area, well, then that affects a different function. And that's why Alzheimer's has it's such a slow disease. These plaques and tangles move very, very slowly through the brain. But it's also a disease of many, many different stages. And in essence, it's a collection of diseases because it starts out with one set of symptoms and then it moves on. And very, very slowly, the thinking process, the general thinking process of a human being essentially becomes erased. And then at the very end stages of the disease, the plaques and tangles are moving to the parts of the brain that control muscles. And that's when the physical manifestations, that's when your body really starts to shut down.
Right. You talk about how very, very early on you start forgetting things like, did I get groceries last night? Or on your way to the grocery store, where am I going? By the time this disease has really progressed to maybe the middle or final stage, you don't even remember what groceries are or what you get at the grocery store. It's like the kind of knowledge or the kind of memories that we're talking about that one loses, that also sort of evolves in a terrible way.
Yeah, I think that so many people who are not familiar with the disease just understand it to be a disease of short-term memory because that's what it's famous for, and that is how the disease begins. But after a couple of years, people enter what we call the confusional state. They are really, it's not just about memories anymore. They are just having severe problems with every aspect of thinking. They are not able to speak properly, make themselves understood. They're not really able to understand what's being said to them. They are having delusions. Their memories are kind of just jumbled in their brain. They're not sure who they are. They're not sure of anything around them. They need 24-hour, 7-day-a-week care. And that's just the middle stages of the disease. And then it moves on to the end stages where we're talking about physical manifestations. We're talking about the parts of the brain that control walking and even breathing and swallowing and things like that begin to shut down.
And I thought it was so interesting. You talk about how one loses all sense of what the future is, of any sense of planning for the future. One eventually loses the ability to have any sense even of awareness or introspection. What a sad thing to lose something like that.
Well, you know, that's a mixed blessing because that actually happens fairly early on in the disease. And to take a philosophical approach to this, that can be considered a blessing because, you know, we were talking earlier about that horrible knowledge of being diagnosed very, very early. On the one hand, it's nice to be able to plan and to talk to your family about it. On the other hand, it's just so awful to have that knowledge of your fate. And one of the blessings here is that very early on in the disease, you lose a part of the awareness of yourself. You can actually still appear to be quite normal and to be talking and walking very ably, but you're not quite aware that you've got this disease. And that gives solace to a lot of caregivers, a lot of family members and friends that at least the patients are not suffering with that existential knowledge of where they're headed.
One of the most interesting things you lay out in the book is this idea that the person succumbing to Alzheimer's is, in effect, living a reverse sort of childhood, that we are losing function in somewhat the same manner that we gain function as we are growing as a youngster, as though somebody said, like the winding and unwinding of a giant ball of string. Alzheimer's unravels the brain almost exactly in the reverse order as it develops from birth. You go on to say that it's actually helpful for us to know what functions are being lost. It helps us in the way that we care for the Alzheimer's victim.
Absolutely, and this is this observation, I'd have to hasten to add, is also as old as the disease itself. If you go back and you look at the early observations of what we now call Alzheimer's disease, you see phrases like second childishness. That was actually Shakespeare's phrase. And even much further back to Aristotle and others writing about this and calling it a sort of a second childhood. And that can feel very demeaning to caregivers that, you know, that we're calling the, their loved ones children, and that's, of course, not what we're doing. But what we're saying is that the abilities of people suffering from the disease are very close, can be eerily mirrored to the abilities of children. And the reason that's so helpful is that, as I said earlier, this is a disease with many, many stages, and those stages are predictable. And a caregiver who's dealing with someone in the early stages of the disease, you know, they've struggled to manage to take to figure out that stage, but they've got to look ahead. They've got to say, all right, in a year or two, I'm going to be dealing with a person who's got this new collection of abilities. And then a couple of years after that, I'm going to be dealing with a person who can't do this, this, and this anymore. So if we know that you know, here is basically this trajectory of this disease, and here are the problems that I'm going to be facing years from now, months and years from now, they can start to plan. Of course, they can't plan for all the turmoil and the burden, but they can do some initial planning, and they can educate themselves about what's coming down the pike, because the stress and the strain on caregivers is just absolutely enormous. Anything we can do to ease that just a little bit is just a very, very important goal.
The final question, what kind of hope is there at this point in time when we still absolutely cannot cure Alzheimer's, nor can we treat it all that effectively? There are medications which do apparently slow down some of these symptoms. Is there a breakthrough out there that can really take us to a different place where we really have more control over Alzheimer's?
Well, here's the good news. The good news is we are going to do some amazing things in the coming years to slow down and perhaps even stop this disease. I can't tell you when it's going to happen exactly, and neither can any scientist, but I can tell you that the thousands and thousands of dedicated scientist warriors in this project are now very optimistic that they're going to be making some inroads very soon. They've learned an awful lot about this disease over the last 10 or 15 years. The molecular biology is now extremely well understood, and we have several drug companies and research outfits who are pursuing actual treatments, actual ways to try to stop the disease. It's not just about discovery anymore. It doesn't give a lot of solace for people who are dealing with this disease right now, because we're talking about, even if there's a breakthrough tomorrow or a year from now, you know, you're talking about in the United States 5 years after that before a drug hits the market. But the people, but it does give the country and the world, and it should give us some sense of optimism that this is not going to be, this is not going to be dragging us down forever. And if we all pay a little more attention to this disease, and we try to improve the level of caregiving for the people suffering from it now, and we put the heat on our political leaders to increase funding for research, we can stop this disease. It is within our power. We can, and frankly, we must, because the social and economic costs are going to be absolutely devastating when the baby boomers start to turn 65 and start to get this disease in serious numbers. So it's a terrible enough disease on a personal level, and it's enough to say that we need to end it for that reason. But if that's not enough for you, just pay attention to the economics. This disease has to be stopped, and all of us need to exercise our responsibility as citizens to try to end this disease.
The book is again called The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic, and the author, David Schenck. David Schenck, I thank you so much for writing this powerful and important book, and I thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for some very thoughtful questions.
Again, this interview with David Schenck, talking about his book, The Forgetting, was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2003. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll again take up the issue of Alzheimer's disease, this time viewed through a very personal lens. My guest will be journalist Mary Ellen Geist, talking about her memoir, Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now we're going to continue our conversation about Alzheimer's disease, but through a very, very different lens. I'm really excited to be able to speak with a man of the stage, a playwright and director by the name of Garrett Davis, who has put together a number of different theatrical presentations, including one called Unforgettable, which is going to be presented this coming Saturday, October 15th, at Tremper High School. Two performances, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m., free and open to the public, sponsored by the Kenosha County ADRC. And in this particular play, we encounter a particular family that is contending with Alzheimer's disease, trying to come to grips with it and trying to figure out how they can best take care of and keep safe their loved one who is falling victim to this terrible disease. If one sees a poster of this presentation, Unforgettable, you see smiling, beaming faces. And so one would not immediately think that this is about a disease as tragic as Alzheimer's. But that is part of the point of this presentation and others that Garrett Davis has put together, tackling some tough issues related to family and health and well-being and caregiving, and trying to do so in such a way that will be energetic and inspiring. So we're going to be talking with Garrett Davis for the next few minutes about this particular presentation, Unforgettable, again, coming to the stage of Tremper High School this coming Saturday. Garrett Davis, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to be speaking with you. And from the looks of it, you have put together a number of theatrical presentations that speak to some very, very personal issues. Explain how this started for you. I mean, where did you first get the idea that you could put together theater that would carry this kind of message? Did this spring from anything in particular?
Well, I guess the start of it came years and years ago when I was traveling with AARP, going from church to church and business to business, and we were doing what we call lunch and learns for senior citizens. And even though I was a playwright and I had a play entitled Forget Me Not that dealt with Alzheimer's, we wasn't talking about the play. What we were doing was really just kind of trying to give the information to communities of color who are, you know, twice as likely to get Alzheimer's disease. And so having my grandmother, who I'm lost to Alzheimer's disease at the time, it was very passionate for me to be a part of these Lunch and Learns. And, you know, it was easy to see by being a playwright that people are attracted to entertainment and people kind of gravitate to a story. And so being able to put a story together, you know, infused with information that can help them give their loved one a better quality of life, that's what inspired me to do this.
Hmm. So one of the things that I said about the poster for Unforgettable is that when we look at it, we would never assume that this particular play is about anything as tragic as Alzheimer's disease. And although I've not yet had the opportunity to see Unforgettable, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I am assuming from just kind of the tenor of that poster that you are trying to approach this in a way that, while not sort of dodging the tragedy of Alzheimer's, is about more than that, about more than just the sadness that we associate with this disease.
Alzheimer's disease is a disease that strips you of your dignity. Alzheimer's is a disease that can put a family in turmoil, especially if they're not prepared for it. And in life, just in life general, regardless of a play, if you or my mother or a loved one has Alzheimer's disease, you know, the first thing that comes up is defense. You really don't want people to know. all that's going on in your house, especially the bad part of it. And there may be some in your inner circle that you let know what's going on, but, you know, for lack of a better phrase, we put that front up. Because we're trying to deal with life and trying to take the best part of life and be positive for it. And so the reason for the smiley faces and, you know, on Alzheimer's, on this play, Unforgettable, is because I want people to know it can hit anybody, but it's all in how you deal with it. You have to find the good moments and the good parts and the resources available to you so that you can make unforgettable moments while our loved ones are still here. It's all about finding the positive in the situation.
Let's return for a moment to your own personal connection with Alzheimer's disease. I would love for you to take a moment to tell us a little bit more about your own grandmother who ultimately succumbed to Alzheimer's disease. Just tell us what that experience was like for you personally, and then we'll see what connections there are between that personal story for you and the story of this fictional family that we will see in your play, Unforgettable.
Well, there may not be any ties between the fictional story and what I went through, but at the end of the day, what I went through as a young college student who came home from spring break, my grandmother was named Goodness, and I was the apple of her eye. When I would walk in the room, she would light up. And coming home from spring break, she didn't light up when she saw me, and I knew something was wrong. I had no idea what the term Alzheimer's was, didn't know what it was. All I knew was the woman that had taken care of me, that I loved so much and loved me, she didn't know who I was. So as a young, immature college student, I couldn't stand to see Goodness like that. And it was years before I even went back home because I just couldn't stand to see it. And I went back to the funeral. And it was years later that, you know, my sisters and my aunts and my mother would tell me that, you know, Goodness would ask about me from time to time. And so I wrote the play, Forget Me Not, as therapy. It was not about my life. It was not about my relationship with Goodness. But I wrote it as therapy to kind of, for the times that I lost because I was too immature and didn't want and afraid to see her like that. And so for 13 years, we toured the play, Forget Me Not. And that's when I became engulfed with trying to find out as much as I could about what took my grandmother. And I became an advocate for the Alzheimer's Association. I became an ambassador for the Alzheimer's Association. And so 13 years later, when it was time for Unforgettable, I wanted to go in a different direction. You know, Forgive Me Not, you know, dealt with an African-American family, dealing with a gentleman, you know, I played the lead, who had Alzheimer's disease. But Unforgettable, you know, 13 years later, I wanted to do a diverse cast. So in addition, we put in African-Americans, we put in Hispanics, we put in Latinos, we put in white, because Alzheimer's disease, although communities of color are twice as likely, it still hits everyone, and I wanted people to look on that stage and be able to see themselves. And that's why we have Scott Sable from American Idol, season 4 finalist, who does an outstanding job, you know, in this play. So, you know, does the parallel, what you see on stage, does it hit my life? No, but some of the stories engulfed, and you'll see on this weekend, deal with the stories that I've heard about, you know, how, you know, mother who used to cook and you know, she's putting the wrong recipe because the Alzheimer's disease it won't allow her to remember the recipe. You'll see that. So it's engulfed with stories that I've heard throughout my journey of raising the awareness of Alzheimer's disease from different families.
We're speaking with playwright Garrett Davis, and his play Unforgettable is going to be presented this coming Saturday, October 15th at 3 and 7 on the stage of Tremper High School. Performances sponsored by the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. So in this new play, Unforgettable, events circle around a woman who is known affectionately as Mama D. Tell us more about the character of Mama D and what some of the first signs are that she is beginning to suffer the effects of Alzheimer's.
Great question. Mama D is a lovely character who was a high school teacher, and she's retired. And she was that person, like in most some communities of color, who kind of take people in. And, you know, Scotty, played by American Idol, season 4 final, Scotty, played by Scott Sable, was one of the gentlemen that she took in through in high school. Shows he's very good friends with her son. And so one of the first signs they see is that she's always looking for her keys. And one of the things about in real life when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, we have a problem trying to differentiate aging regular normal aging with the signs of Alzheimer's. And so just because you walk out of Walmart and you can't find your car doesn't mean you have Alzheimer's disease. Now, if you get in the wrong car, that's a different story. But she can't find her keys. She's forgetting certain things. But because the house is so busy, because she's living with her son, his wife, her son, and her grandson, you know, it's overlooked. The small things are overlooked. And what happens when it really gets noticed is when she messes up a recipe. And she so happens to put something, an ingredient, in the recipe that that her son is allergic to that he could die. Now, of course, you know, in normal life, we wouldn't do that. But, you know, when that happens, and so the key thing that I want people to notice, you know, all the attention is going into, you know, the daughter-in-law is trying to convince her husband that something is wrong with his mother. But, of course, he's defensive. He doesn't want anyone talking about his mother. No one is looking at the real problem. What they're looking at is how the problem is being dealt with. And that's something that happens in a lot of communities. It's not what's happening, but why is it happening? And, you know, who's going to do this and who's going to do that? And no attention is paid to the person who has Alzheimer's disease. Yet everyone is trying to deal with the effects, how Alzheimer's disease is affecting everyone else.
Hmm. I noticed on your website that one of your missions in life, with especially some of your plays, is to for the importance of taking care of the caregiver. That is that often, although we do need, of course, to focus on the person whose life is being engulfed by Alzheimer's very directly, that in fact those who care for such a person, their lives get engulfed as well, and we don't always stop to think about the special burden of responsibility that is borne by caregivers. And I don't mean so much professional caregivers, although they're important too, but I mean just family members who suddenly find themselves having to play a very different role in someone else's life, who perhaps has been a parent or caregiver for them, and now suddenly those roles must be reversed. What are some of the things you want us to better understand and appreciate about caregiving under these challenging circumstances?
The first thing I want, caregivers, I'll call them primary caregivers. In other words, let's pretend we have a family of five and mother has Alzheimer's disease. Well, you don't get a call in the middle of the night that says, "Mom, you have to be a caregiver tomorrow." You may get a call that says, "Mom failed, meet me at the hospital." You get to the hospital and they tell you that, you know, mom's going to need somebody to take care of her. She can't be alone. Well, you know who ends up being the caregiver? The person who lives closest to mom. While your other brothers and sisters in other cities and other neighborhoods and other states call and tell you what to do. And so that's stressful in and of itself. We haven't even got to the caregiving part. I'm just looking at the primary caregiver. The next thing is I want caregivers to admit that they're caregivers. So what happens a lot of times is that I'm trying to be the best son I can be. I don't look at myself as a caregiver. I'm looking at myself as a son, or I'm looking at myself as a daughter trying to take care of my mother. So if I don't look at myself as a caregiver, I never open myself up to the resources that are available to me to take care of my mother. A lot of times, you know, families fight amongst each other trying to make sure that the load is shared equally. And that, a lot of times, is never going to happen. And so with that primary caregiver, I first want them to understand that, you know, spiritually, for those, you know, that's just my belief, if you are the primary caregiver, that's something that you are assigned to do. It's a reason why you're the primary caregiver. Everybody can't handle that responsibility. And so if you're not that primary caregiver, the thing should be to, I need to make sure that I give my brother or my sister all the help that I can give them so they can better take care of my mother or my father. It's not about me trying to make them do what I want them to do. At the same time, it's about me getting the help that I need, whether it comes from a brother, a sister, a community friend, a church partner, a coworker. It's all about doing this together. But a lot of times primary caregivers get caught up into fussing and fighting with siblings, trying to get them to do something that they really don't want to do, because it's not that they don't want to take care of their mother, my man. It could be a situation where they can't stand to see her like that, so they come up with excuses not to be around.
Mm. That's the oldest trick in the book, isn't it? And it's understandable why people will fall into that that sort of trap. And of course, that speaks to what you were saying about your own beloved grandmother and how you just couldn't bear the feeling of being in her presence when she didn't know you. And of course, you probably regret now that at a young age you weren't able to process that bewilderment a little bit better than you did. So this play, Unforgettable, as you have already touched on, includes a couple of very, very fine singers in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to tell our listeners a little bit more about that. And does music figure at all in the play, Unforgettable, or are they cast for other reasons than their musical talents?
No, there's music. There's definitely songs within, but it's not a musical. But there are instances that we have over occasions where songs are sung, and you know, without giving away too much, American Idol finalist Scott Sable does an amazing job of trying to tell Mama D how important she is to him. But Mama D is slipping. You know, that Mama D goes. Sometimes she remembers him, and sometimes she doesn't. And man, that's very hard for him because he was, you know, while in school, he was on the wrong path, and Mama D helped him get back on track. And so when he sings that song, Take a Look at Me Now, I mean, it's a tearjerker. And so one of the things about this particular play, you're going to laugh, you're going to be informed, but it's definitely a tearjerker. There are some moments, you know, the song selections that we've chosen, this, you know, a wide range. I won't give all of them away since I've already given you one. But, you know, these characters were chosen because of the singing ability and acting ability. We wanted to be very entertaining, but yet very, very informative. So we're going to try to strike a good balance.
And is this play performed on what we would think of as a conventional set? I mean, and is this a set that goes with you along with costumes and so on to wherever you present this?
Yeah. Yes, it is. You know, there's a huge set that goes with this. So when you come in, it's like you're going to see a house on stage. So, yes, it's a national traveling show. We started back in July of this year. We opened the show up in Atlanta, then from Atlanta to Charlotte to Greensboro to Bowie, Maryland, and now Kenosha, and then we have a little small break, and then in November we head out to the West Coast. We're in Vegas and LA and Sacramento and all of that on the West Coast starting, you know, in November. But yeah, this is definitely a traveling show, and a lot of times people may say, well, you know, why are you doing this show for free, and how is a show like this or this magnitude, why is it free? At the end of the day, cost cannot be a factor when it comes to giving information to a group of people. They need to take better quality of life for their loved ones. And so that's why this is free. And that's why the Kenosha, you know, ADRC, along with the Alzheimer's Association, along with our company, we made sure that, you know, as we go from state to state and city to city, you know, this event is free because we want people to come and be inspired. And the main reason that we're doing this, you know, under the, you know, the auspices of entertainment is to create relationships so that those resource centers that are in Kenosha, hopefully now when people see this place, something will be sparked and say, you know what, I need to connect with the local Alzheimer's Association, or I need to connect with the ADRC, and I need to kind of find out more information. The thing is trying to get out in front of this, because we all know once it's hit and once we're overwhelmed, we make decisions that we don't need to because we're fed up, because we're tired, because we can't take it anymore. And that's when we make bad decisions, and we want to be able to do this and get out in front.
Hmm. The play, again, is Unforgettable by Garrett Davis. Two free performances this coming Saturday, October 15th at 3 p.m. and at 7 p.m. In the auditorium at Tremper High School. That's down on the south side of Kenosha, 8560 26th Avenue. Again, both performances are free, but you are asked to pre-register in order to attend. And you can do that, securing free tickets, by going to www.unforgettableplay.com. Again, www.unforgettableplay.com. You can also get more information by calling the Kenosha County ADRC at 262-605-6646. And again, Unforgettable is by Garrett Davis. Garrett Davis, thank you so much, first of all, for all the good that you're doing in the world with these presentations, and I appreciate you making time in your schedule to be my morning show guest today. Thank you, and best wishes to you and to the entire cast of Unforgettable.
Thank you so much.